Okay, so our speaker today is Wolfgang Wieland, who's going to speak about the spin foam action.
Thank you, Jorge, and welcome everyone. And thank you in particular for giving me this opportunity to speak about the recent work that I've been doing here at Penn State. So let us go to the second slide, slide number two. In this talk, I will present an action for simplicial gravity in terms of first-order area connection variables. The theory has a Hamiltonian and local gauge symmetries. Generic solutions represent twisted geometries that appear in the semi-classical limit of loop quantum gravity, and these solutions have curvature because there is a deficit angle around the elementary triangles in the simplicial complex. This talk is divided in three parts. First of all, I will give you a general impression of what the spin foam approach is actually all about. In the second part, I will use the classical formulation of the spin foam approach, so the spin foam action. I will speak about its evolution equations, that there is a Hamiltonian formulation of the equations of motion, and that generic solutions have a geometric interpretation in terms of twisted geometry. I will close with a summary and short outlook. So this talk is based on a series of papers that I have been working on here at Penn State and doing my PhD in Marseille. It also led to a collaboration with Marina Cortes and Lee Smolin from the Parameter Institute. Most of the calculations are based on the spinorial or rather twistorial formulation of formalism of loop quantum gravity that has been introduced by Friedel and Speciale in 2010. Let me now go to the next slide, number three. So now I'm going to tell you what the spin foam approach is actually all about and what is the general idea. So let us go to the next slide, slide number four. In any approach to quantum gravity, at some point we have to address the dynamics, that is, to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt constraint equation. In the canonical approach to quantum gravity or to loop quantum gravity, one focuses kind of on the left-hand side of equation one. So one tries to define the Hamiltonian constraint operator, either on the kinematical Hilbert space or already on the deep invariant level through a master constraint approach. In spin foams, we are following a different perspective. We are trying to impose or implement the general idea of Hartley and Hawking, which has been introduced in 1983 in the paper Wave Function of the Universe. The idea is to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation through a path integral approach, that is to find the kernel of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation on a fixed four-dimensional manifold. So this is in equation two. The path integral is all overall metric contributions in the bulk and weighted by the exponential of I times the Einstein-Hilbert action. The integral is such that it is over fixed boundary configurations, HAB, on the three-dimensional boundary of the manifold. And the idea is to solve this path integral in a kind of lattice approach on a simplicial decomposition of the four-dimensional manifold. Now, in loop quantum gravity, instead of three geometries on the boundary, we have quantum states labeled by spin numbers J for each dimensional surface and intertwiners on each node. And this path integral turns into a regularized expression, which is the sum over intertwiners and spins at faces and vertices. So let us now go to the slide number five, where we'll speak about the EPRL model, which is a concrete proposal realizing these ideas. So there are a number of interesting and, in fact, very promising results. One of them is by Carlo Rovelli, one of the first results, namely that on a fixed four simplex, one recovers the graviton propagator of the perturbative theory. Also, in the large spin regime, which has been shown by Frank Hellman and Barrett and collaborators, one recovers the Regge action, but only locally on a fixed force index. Also, it is possible to account for a positive cosmological constant, to add fermions, Young-Mills fields, to study cosmology and the horizon thermodynamics. But despite all of these promising results, there's also an ongoing debate which concerns a number of questions. First of all, and this is the most important question, is whether we can actually recover a continuum formulation, so continuum general relativity. And this question mostly focuses on a conceptual aspect, namely in which way we should approach the continuum limit, if it should be achieved via a summing of all two complexes or through a refining limit. Then another question is whether we miss actually additional constraints, which would be secondary constraints in the Hamiltonian analysis and would correspond to torsional degrees of freedom. Then it has been argued that there is a flatness problem, and it is also an open question whether we can introduce a notion of causality in spin forms. So the flatness problem has been, Abai just asked what is the flatness problem. This has been found by Hellman and Bonsom and others. And the issue is whether, it has been shown that for one force simplex, one actually recovers Regge action. But the question is whether this also holds if we go if we study the entire force entire simplicial decomposition, so whether we can whether we recover the Regge action everywhere, and this is an open problem, and there is a controversy in the literature about this issue. The statement is that one would actually just get flat contributions, so just flat holonomies in a simplicial phase. But I think all of these questions have little to do with the quantum theory itself. All of them are rather questions that already appear at the classical level. And what we need, in fact, in my opinion, is a framework of simplicial gravity that can address these questions in the spinform approach. So let me go to the next slide, slide number 5, where I give you the general idea of the program. So a local spinform model assigns amplitudes to the individual building blocks of the simplicial complex, namely a phase amplitude to each two-dimensional phase appearing in the complex, possibly also edge amplitudes and vertex amplitudes. Now in the semi-classical limit, these amplitudes turn into action functionals. And we can now completely forget about the quantum theory and just ask whether we can write down a reasonable action for spin foams with the same field content as loop quantum gravity. So to say an action that would naturally correspond to the semi-classical limit of the quantum theory. So is there a theory of simplicial gravity in terms of our Ashtekar-Barbero variables? And this will be the main question of this talk. Is there a question? No. So instead of going to slide number 7, where I would further motivate this approach, let us already go to slide number 8. So now I will introduce this spinform action formalism, which is a purely classical approach. So let us go to the next slide, slide number 9. In loop quantum gravity, or in the spinform approach, we try to implement the Blavatsky principle in the discrete theory. So the Blavatsky principle is just a statement that we can understand general relativity as a constrained topological theory. In fact, what we start with is just the BF action, which is topological, but it is important for us because it shares with general relativity the same symplectic structure. So So this action I've written down in equation 4. And just look at the right-hand side of this equation. So this action is just a two-form field pi, which plays the role of the momentum variable, contracted with the curvature tensor F. And indices alpha, beta refer to internal Lorentz space. So pi alpha, beta is, in fact, an SO13-valued SO13-Lie algebra-valued two-form. Now, as I told you, this action is, of course, topological. But what is important for us is that it reduces to general relativity once we impose the simplicity constraints, which I've written down in equation 5, which guarantee the existence of a tetrad E alpha. So there are the two solutions, sigma alpha beta equal E veg E, and it's Hodge dual. And the existence or the appearance of the Barbero immersive parameter in the action guarantees that for both cases, this action reduces to an action for general relativity. Let us go now, after having introduced this, to the next slide, slide number 10. Here I present you already the general result, which I will explain you in more detail in the following slides. So the result is that if we take simplicial decomposition of our four-dimensional manifold, so we decompose the manifold into four simplices glued among bounding tetrahedra, then we can write down the discretized DF action, so the discretized topological action, as a sum over the contributions from the two-dimensional faces. So what are these two-dimensional faces? They are the dual of the triangles in the simplicial decomposition. And if we are working in the spinorial formulation, the resulting action I've written down in equation 7. So the details here are not important at the moment. What you should recognize is that this action is just a symplectic potential for these spinors. So pi and omega are spinors, and A, B, C, and so on are spinor indices, so they take values from 0 to 1. And this is an integral for each two-dimensional phase in the simplicial decomposition. It is, in fact, an integral over the boundary of F, and we integrate this, so the first two terms are just a symplectic potential, and the next term is a constraint that reduces these spinors to the holonomy flux variables of the BF theory. So to explain this in more detail, so to give you an idea how one arrives at this equation and this action, let us go to the next slide, slide number 11. So the... Yes?
Hello? The question for clarifying the notation. Here, each edge has as many independent spinors as faces sharing their edge, right?
Exactly. So so this is an action, so the sum goes over all faces. So if you look just at one edge in this discretization, so and the edges are bounding the individual faces, and each of these edges is dual to a tetrahedron. So if you now isolate just the contribution in this action from one single edge, we find four contributions, namely from all four faces that are adjacent to this one single edge. And how can we understand these four faces belonging to each edge? Well, each face is dual to a tetrahedron, but each tetrahedron contains four triangles. And each of these triangles is again dual to a face. So there are four faces for each edge. Yes. So let us go. Let me now explain this action in more detail. So the idea of the construction is as follows. So first of all, we study with the BF action, which is the integral. So we are now in step one of pi alpha beta veg F alpha beta. F alpha beta is the curvature two form. in which takes values in the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group, and pi alpha beta is the momentum variable, which is again a two form. And now what we are now doing is a kind of point splitting regularization where we decompose this integral in two parts. In fact, we can write this four-dimensional integral as a sum over phases, where the curvature tensor is integrated over the two-dimensional phases, which are dual to the triangles, and the momentum variable, so pi alpha beta, is integrated over the triangles tau sub f, which are dual to each of these two-dimensional phases. And so we have a sum of all phases. And what I now do is to look at each of these two parts, so the integral over pi alpha beta and the integral over f separately, and study it, it step by step. So now we go to step number two. Now we define the integral over the momentum variable pi over each triangle. And what I have written down here is the two-dimensional integral over dx, dy, these are coordinates on your triangle, integrated over the triangle dual to the phase. And now there are additional holonomies that map all of these spinors, all of these indices into a common frame. Now, this has to be done to maintain gauge invariance, because we cannot add internal Lorentz vectors that belong to different frames in the simplicial complex. Therefore, we have to introduce these holonomies. And where do they map all these indices into? They map them, so I choose a path gamma that maps gamma t of xy that maps each point on the triangle, which is labeled by x and y, into a point labeled by t on the boundary of the spin form phase. So this gives the definition of the smeared momentum variable. Now we do the same strategy also for the second piece in step one, namely the integral over the curvature tensor. And for this, we employ the non-abelian Stokes theorem. In fact, we can express the curvature tensor smeared over the two-dimensional phase just as a covariant t derivative into the direction of the edge of the holonomy h gamma t that connects a point in the boundary of the phase with the center of the spin form phase. And if we bring these two pieces together, we end up with the equation on the bottom of this slide, which tells us that we can write the contribution from each phase as just this contraction of the smeared flux with the covariant t derivative of these link holonomies. And in the next step, so now we go to slide number 12, we introduce the spinors because they are a powerful tool to parameterize these variables. In fact, if we have this momentum variable pi, which is takes values in the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group, we can always find a pair of spinors, pi omega and pi, that diagonalize them. And we can now use these very same spinors to also diagonalize the holonomy h gamma t that maps a point in the boundary of the spin form phase, that is a point on the edge into the center of the spin form phase. What we now also need is an additional constraint that reduces these spinors to holonomy flux variables, and this is the area matching constraint. And if we now bring all these pieces together, we find that the contribution from the BF action that comes from a single phase in the two-dimensional discretization is just given by equation 9. So pi and omega, pi sub A and omega to the A, these are the spinors that diagonalize our flux variables, so the geometric variables. D over dp, capital D over dp, is a covariant derivative that tells us how these spinors change as we move forward along the edge. And delta is a constraint that reduces the spinorial variables back to the original variables in the BF action, namely to holonomy flux variables. And complex CC is the complex conjugate that guarantees that the action is real. So that is the contribution from one phase in the Simplicial complex. To get an expression for the discretized BF action, we just have to add all of these contributions from the individual phases. And this gives then a discrete regularization or discrete expression for the BF action. What we now have to ask is how we add the simplicity constraints to this discretized spinorial action that would eventually reduce the theory to general relativity. So let us go to the next slide, slide number 13. So we know that the quadratic simplicity constraints that I've written in equation 10, so the wedge, so sigma alpha beta, this two-form wedge sigma mu nu, should be proportional to epsilon alpha beta mu nu, guarantees the existence of a tetrad. However, this form of the simplicity constraint is not very useful for us because we cannot easily discretize it in the Simplicial complex. Instead, we use a linear version of this constraint. In fact, we demand that for every tetrahedron, which is dual to these one-dimensional edges, there should exist an internal future-oriented time normal n alpha, such that the integrated fluxes over the triangles annihilate this internal normal, such that sigma alpha beta integrated over the triangle contracted with this normal vanishes. Now this guarantees that each of these integrated fluxes, so the integral over sigma alpha beta over a triangle, is simple, which means that they define a plane in the internal Minkowski space, a plane orthogonal to the normal that we have introduced. And now we are working, however, in the spinorial framework, so we have to express these linear constraints, which I've given you in equation 11, in terms of the spinorial variables. And what I get are the equations 12a and 12b, which express these linear simplicity constraints in terms of the spinors for each triangle. Equation 12a is, so these are three equations. So, and I will explain you why there are three. So equation 12a is a Lorentz invariant contraction of the spinors, and it is real. So this is one equation. Equation 12b is the contraction of the spinors with the time normal n, expressed in as a matrix through the soldering forms, and this is a complex equation. It is only invariant under the Lidl group preserving the time normal, and so because it's a complex equation, these are two equations, so in total we have three equations, three constraints for each triangle, and these are the simplicity constraints.
Sorry, comment. In order to appreciate the motivation of your work, maybe you could stress that there is some difference between 10 and 11, right? In the sense that 11 only captures a spatial projection of 10?
Yes. So I should also say that in which sense are equation 10 and 11, in which sense do equation 10 and 11 capture the same geometric information? In fact, what one finds is that if we impose equation 11 for each for all tetrahedra in a for all five tetrahedra in a four simplex, together with the Gauss constraint, which is the closure constraint of all the triangles, then this is equivalent to equation 10, provided the geometry is locally flat. So in this sense, equation 11, together with the Gauss constraint that appears in the action anyway, is equivalent to equation 10. So there has also been a question by Abai.
Would you explain why equation 11 is being put with the
Yes. Yes.
Please repeat the question.
So the question of Abai was why equation 11 is geometrically meaningful, because here the equation 11 has one free index, but the integral goes over a two-dimensional surface. But I just explained to you that it is not geometrically meaningful to smear Lorentz quantities at different points. So, in fact, what appears here, which I have not written down just for simplicity, are additional holonomies in this integral that map all indices into a common frame. And once you have mapped all internal indices into a common frame, you can perform the integral over the triangle in a meaningful way. And this is implicitly hidden here. But in all previous formulas, I've done this, so it should be okay. So let us go to the next slide, slide number 14. Now we want to add these simplicity constraints to our action. And the first consequence of this is that the SO13 connection that appears in the covariant derivative of this spinos reduces to an SU2 connection, in fact to an SU2N connection, where N refers to this internal time normal. So it's a connection in the little group corresponding to this internal normal. And it is, in fact, just the Ashtekar-Barbero connection that I can construct out of this SO13 connection. The second consequence is that I now need additional Lagrange multipliers in order to add these constraints to the action. And what I then get is, for each phase in the discretization, the following action that I've written down in equation 14. So the first two parts, so pi A, B omega A, and pi tilde A, B omega tilde A, these are again just the contribution from the BF action, where I've replaced, of course, the SO13 covariant derivative by the SU2 covariant derivative, thanks to the addition of the simplicity constraints. The third term is again this constraint, which we call the area matching constraint, that reduces spinos to holonomy flux variables. The remaining terms in the second line are the simplicity constraints that impose the geometricity of the fluxes, so that each of these fluxes defines a plane in Minkowski space. But now there is a problem, because by going to the linear simplicity constraints, we have introduced an additional element to our theory, namely the time normal n alpha that determines the normal to the elementary triangles in the discretization. And now we have to give some dynamics to these variables, because otherwise this action is misses a piece. Otherwise, we don't know how n alpha, so this internal time normal, would depend on the time parameter t that I have along these edges. And now we have to make a proposal for this. But we cannot just guess this out of the blue sky. We have to make a reasonable proposal. So let us go to slide number 15. First of all, I want to understand the geometric geometric interpretation of these time normals and what constraints they have to obey, such that I find a proposal that is consistent with these conditions. In fact, any proposal that one can construct must respect the closure constraint at the vertices. If we define p alpha in equation 15 as this normal that I've introduced previously, so the time normal n alpha weighted by the volume of the tetrahedron, then I find a closure constraint at each force simplex, namely in equation 16, that the sum over these momentum variables p over all outgoing edges must be the same as the sum over all p for incoming edges, where the volume is, of course, the volume of the tetrahedron as expressed in terms of the fluxes at the bottom of this slide. And now I want to give you a proposal for an action that determines the time dependence of this normal, which is consistent with disclosure constraint 16. But before I do so, let me first tell you the geometric or the geometric origin of this closure constraint. And this I will for this we will go to the next slide, slide number 15. So what is the geometric origin or the geometric meaning of this closure constraint? Where does it come from? In fact, just as the Gauss, we know that the Gauss constraint represents the vanishing of the Gauss constraint corresponds to captures some components of the vanishing of torsion. In fact, the vanishing of torsion just tells us that the exterior covariant derivative of the tetrad, as written in equation 17, vanishes. But if the exterior covariant derivative of the tetrad vanishes, it also implies equation 18, namely that the triple exterior product of three tetrads also vanishes. But epsilon alpha beta mu nu contracted with E beta which E mu which E nu is just a three-dimensional volume element. And if we integrate this three-dimensional volume element over each tetrahedron, as written down in equation 20, and employ a non-abelian version of the Stokes theorem, then we get equation 19, namely a conservation law of these volume-weighted normals at each vertex of the simplicial decomposition. So that is the geometric origin of this closure constraint. It just captures some components of the vanishing of torsion. And now I want to give you a proposal for dynamics for these time normals, which is consistent with this four-dimensional closure constraint. And for this, we go to the next slide, slide number 17, please. So as I just told you, any proposal for the dynamics of these time normals must respect the four-dimensional closure constraint. But it must, of course, also be consistent with all symmetries of the action. One of these symmetries is still the internal rotational symmetry, the SU2 symmetry that preserves the internal normal n, so the normal of each tetrahedron. So an action that respects both of these conditions I've given you in equation 21. So what does it consist of? Well, the first term is just a symplectic potential. It tells us that these volume-weighted time normals have a conjugate momentum, which I call just x. But then there's also a constraint, which is the second piece of this action, which tells us that these volume-weighted normals have actually measured the norm, such that the Minkowski norm is proportional to the squared volume of the tetrahedron. So therefore, this action depends not only on P and X, but also on a Lagrange multiplier N, which plays the role of a kind of Laplace function, and the spinors, or which are hidden in the definition of the volume functional. If you now want to add this action to the action that I've previously introduced, then we need additional boundary terms to make the action functionally differentiable. That is just a term for each vertex in the discretization, and it is of little importance for the rest of the discussion. But what is important is that the constraint which I've added to this action takes the form of a Marshall condition. Namely, it tells us that the norm of this momentum variable pi, p, which is the volume-weighted normal of each tetrahedron, is proportional to the squared volume of each tetrahedron. So let us now go to the next slide. So now we just add the individual pieces. So the first to get an action for the entire simplicial decomposition. So there's a sum of our faces, of our edges, and of our vertices in the discretization. The face action comes from the original BF action. So it is the BF part plus the simplicity constraints. It depends on the spinors, set and set tilde, that diagonalize the holonomy or parametrize the holonomy flux variables, number of Lagrange multipliers, theta, set, and lambda, that impose the simplicity constraints and impose the area matching condition that reduce spinors to holonomy flux variables. But it also implicitly depends on the connection through the time covariant time derivative and the normal. And the other two parts of this action are the edge action that I've introduced in the last slide, so that determines the time evolution of the momentum variables, and the boundary term as vertex at the individual vertices of the simplicial decomposition. So this gives now a proposal for a classical action for spin forms. And the idea is that this action, that instead of just studying the semi-classical limit and of the spin form amplitudes and see whether it corresponds to some form of Redshift action, we should take this action as our classical starting point for the quantization program. So let us now go. So now, once we have an action, I can just look at the equations of motion and ask whether they have anything to do with geometry or gravity. So for this, let us go to the next slide, to the last chapter of this seminar. So to the where I will tell you that the equations of motion have, as derived from this action, have a Hamiltonian formulation, that solutions of the equations of motion have a geometric interpretation in terms of twisted geometries, which appear in the semi-classical limit of the loop quantum gravity boundary states, and that there is also curvature around the triangles in the discretization. At this point, maybe I should ask if there are any questions. Otherwise, I would continue.
Okay. I don't know if you should discuss this now or at the end, so whichever is more convenient. But normally, when we have action in field theory and we discretize it, right, we don't necessarily have a time variable. I mean, in four-dimensional action, I just particularly if the cell decomposition is four-dimensional and not 3 plus 1, so to say. But here you keep talking about time. And what does it have to do with time that everybody in general relativity calls time? What does your parameter t have to do with what everybody in general relativity calls time?
Well, so in general relativity, there is no unique notion of time. So, so there are, of course, different notions of time. So this parameter that I call time, I would say is in spirit the same type of parameter that also appears in the ADM action. So it is just a parameter with respect to which we express the equations of motion in a first order form. But of course it is also very different from an ADM time variable because it's not a global time variable. It is only a local parameter along each edge. So that makes it very different from the ADM T variable. So,
can I add something?
Please, yeah.
Yeah, you might point out that you're assuming that the edges are all time-like because they're dual to a tetrahedra, which is face-like. The faces are also all face-like, and therefore your integral over time variable is over a variable which is timeline.
Yes. Thank you, Lee, for reminding me of that and pointing that out.
Yeah, but it's time-like in the internal space. I don't see what it has to do with space-time time-like. And secondly, if you want to talk about kind of discretization of space-time, like in causal dynamical triangulation, then the time variable will be discrete. You go from one tetrahedron, which represents kind of locally one instant of time, to the next one. Here the time variable is continuous. So even within each tetrahedron, so to say, the time is running. And so I kind of feel that either one is doing something very revolutionary, or one is just using terms which one should legally not use, like time. It has nothing to do with the time evolution that we talk about in general relativity. Let me just put it differently and then stop. Namely, that this is some discretization, and then I will get some solutions to this discrete theory. And as the last part, I think Wolfgang is going to discuss, what does it have to do with geometry and what does it have to do with Einstein's equation? So in this geometrical interpretation, I should see this evolution as being a time evolution with respect to some foliation. And the question is that the case or is that not the case? And if it's not the case, then, you know, why are we calling it time? But perhaps we should discuss this at the end, if you like, because I don't want to stop.
Let's just continue. So now we are on slide number 19, and we are going to slide number 20. So now, once I have an action, I can make three immediate tests. First of all, is there a Hamiltonian formulation of the dynamics of this theory? So that is important because we would like to eventually quantize this model, and therefore Hamiltonian formulation is very important for us. Second point is, do the solutions of the equations of motion have anything to do with geometry? Because general relativity is just a theory of geometry, so we should ask, do the solutions of the equations of motion have a geometric interpretation? And the last point, whether there is also curvature. So let me go to the first, to the next slide, slide number 21. So the action has just one continuous parameter, which is t. And if I now study the equations of motion with respect to t, this t parameter, then I can write down those equations in a Hamiltonian form. So these are now equations that just govern the t dependence of these configuration variables along the edges of the discretization. And this equation I've given you in 26. So there's actually a Hamiltonian, which is just a sum over constraints that generates the t dependence of these elementary configuration variables. So what are the configuration variables? Well, they are the spinors on all the faces and these additional momenta, p, on all edges, and the canonical conjugate variables x. And now it just so happens that the equations of motion as derived from this one-dimensional action have a Hamiltonian form. Now, because the Hamiltonian is just a sum over constraints, I have to ask, of course, whether the constraints are preserved in time, which leads me to the Dirac algorithm or the Dirac analysis of this system in slide number 22. So I don't want to go through all of this. I just want to tell you that there are both first and second class constraints. In fact, one of the simplicity constraints is second class. And what I then find is that the Hamiltonian preserves all constraints of the system, just provided the Lagrange multiplier in front of the second class constraints vanishes, which is what typically happens in systems with second-class constraints. And what are the constraints? Well, there's the SU2 Gauss constraint for each tetrahedron. Then there are the, which I call G. Then there are the area matching constraints delta, which reduce the spinorial variables to the holonomy flux variables. And there are the simplicity constraints V and W, that impose the geometricity or the simplicity of each of the triangles. Let me now go to the next slide, slide number 23. So what does all of this has to do with geometry? Do the solutions of the equations of motion have anything to do with geometry? Well, first of all, we can look at the solutions of the simplicity constraints. And in fact, they guarantee that the integrated fluxes sigma alpha beta over the elementary triangles in the discretization, define planes in the internal Minkowski space, so that this is not any Lie algebra element, but it's a simple element that defines a plane. Then the Gauss constraint tells us that these planes close. They close to form a tetrahedron. And now we can take these configurations and evolve them by the Hamiltonian of the theory, which I've introduced to you on the previous slide. And what I find is that this Hamiltonian generates twisted geometries that appear in the semi-classical limit of our theory. And in fact, the relevant term is easy to identify. It's just this Marshall condition C that tells us that the that these momenta that are associated to each edge are proportional, that the norm of them is proportional to the volume of the tetrahedron itself. So there's a piece in the Hamiltonian which is proportional to the squared volume of the tetrahedron. But the Hamiltonian flow that is generated by the volume of the tetrahedron, that has already been studied some time ago by Eugenio Bianchi and Hal Haggard. And in fact, what they find is that the volume functional in loop quantum gravity does not preserve the shape of a tetrahedron. It generates actually a shear that transforms the tetrahedra non-trivially. And therefore, to each of the edges of the discretization, we can associate a tetrahedron, but this tetrahedron has not a unique shape. As we move forward along the edge, going from one vertex to another vertex, these tetrahedra look differently. And therefore, each triangle in the discretization has a unique area, but it does not have a unique shape, which leads us to a, which is precisely what appears in the twisted geometries framework. And then, if we then we can now go to slide number 24, where I will speak about. Let me just mention it briefly. So, in Regge calculus, curvature is concentrated on two-dimensional surfaces. So there's a deficit angle for each triangle. And something similar also happens here. In fact, if we collect the intertetrahedral angles, so to say, between any two neighboring tetrahedra in a vertex and collect these angles as we go around a face, so we collect these boost angles psi b vertex phase, and we sum them up by going once around a phase, then we find that the resulting, that this sum is proportional to the Lagrange multiplier imposing one of the simplicity constraints. So in fact, curvature is proportional to a Lagrange multiplier imposing the simplicity constraints. And that is the same kind of thing that happens in the continuum formulation of Blavatsky theory. In fact, if we look at the Blavatsky action, then also the curvature, so the Riemann tensor, turns out to be proportional to the Lagrange multiplier imposing the simplicity constraints, which in the case of Blavatsky is, of course, just the Weyl tensor. And something similar in spirit at least happens here. So the deficit angle, psi, for each phase, which is a measure of the curvature in the phase, is proportional to the Lagrange multiplier lambda imposing one of the simplicity constraints. So now I can already conclude. We go to slide number 25, and I will give you a summary of this action or formulation. So first of all, the action that I've proposed is a one-dimensional action for the entire spin form. And this action is an integral. So it's an integral over the t variable parametrizing the edges of the discretization. And that means that there's a notion of continuity, because all fields are continuous along these edges, and the dependence of all fields on this parameter, t parameterizing the edges, is governed by a Hamiltonian equation. Then there's also the hope that this opens a way to introduce a notion of causality to spin forms, because all of these edges are oriented, and we can now we can therefore distinguish future pointing from past pointing edges, which gives us a notion of causality. Then I've told you that the Hamiltonian that determines the key dependence of the configuration variables generates twisted geometries. So there is a geometric interpretation of the solutions of the equations of motion. What I found one of the most intriguing features of this model is that there seems to be a kind of particle picture now emerging in spin forms. In fact, one could argue that every tetrahedron in this simplicial complex behaves like a massive particle with some internal HU2 degrees of freedom, which belong to the little group preserving the time direction of the tetrahedron. With each of these particle momenta being equal to the volume-weighted four normals. And what happens is that mass turns into volume, and volume is quantized into quantum gravity. So thank you for your attention.
Questions?
So I have a technical question maybe about your equation 32. Yes. So this new constraint you have added, this four-dimensional closure, has not changed the fact that the diagonal simplicity constraint is first class. So in equation 32, you talk about the deficit angle around the triangle, which is nice that it's non-zero, so the model can have curvature. But this appears to be just a pure gauge because it's proportional to the Lagrange multiplier of a first-class constraint. So my question is, would you expect at some point maybe in a further development some extra constraints that would change this gauge nature of the deficit angle, or am I just misinterpreting this result maybe?
So if you look at equation 32, indeed, it is just proportional to a Lagrange multiplier. But it is also an integral, it's a closed integral. So, and what happens is that this integral is independent of the gauge, because under a gauge, lambda just changes by a total derivative, and this falls out of this equation. So, although it is just an integral of a Lagrange multiplier, yet it is gauge invariant. That is kind of surprising.
Its value, it's arbitrary. That's what I mean.
No, its value is determined by this equation to be a sum over just the dihedral angles. So that makes it gauge invariant.
Sorry, should I read this? So, no, maybe I misunderstood. Okay. So I thought I should have read this equation as fixing psi, which are free in terms of lambda. Now you're saying that's not the way to think about it.
No, it's the other way around. It fixes lambda in terms of psi. So you can only have a... so lambda is a continuous variable around this and at the along the boundary of F. And I can only allow such a configuration of lambda that obeys this condition, this equation 32.
So there is a piece of the... of these diagonal simplicity constraints that somehow is second class because its Lagrange multiplier is being fixed, which is this integral version of it. Am I right?
No.
Well, maybe we can discuss this further. It was just a technical. Thank you.
I mean, I just wanted to say that lambda is not, little lambda is not fixed, right? I mean, it's only constrained. I mean, am I right about that?
So one can still perform gauge transformations in lambda, which would not change this value, because it's a closed integral.
But maybe you are asking something else, Simone. Please go ahead.
On a gauge transformation, lambda just changes by a total derivative, which falls out of this integral.
So I guess what I'm asking is that in the dynamical theory, somehow the deficit angles should You know, like suppose that we take the intuition from Regge calculus. These are just the specific functions of the edge length, and then looking at the equations for the edge length tells us what is the dynamical curvature in the solution. So far at this level of equations of motion, these deficit angles are still completely free. And they're not given by any function of edge length or anything like this. They're just free and fixed to an arbitrary Lagrange multiplier. In this sense, they're still free.
No, psi is defined in equation 31. So it is the inner product of two of these time normals meeting at the vertex. And these time normals, again, are not arbitrary because they constrain they appear in the simplicity constraints. So everything is a tangled system of equations.
So what are the equations of motions for the normals then? That would be my question, I guess.
So the normals are constant along the edges. That is why I introduced an additional term in the action that determines the time dependence of these normals.
And finally, they are constant. Okay.
Yes. It's constant because it behaves like a free particle.
They interact with vertices.
Exactly.
I have a question about your action on page 18, the spinform action.
Yes.
Now that you have a classical action, can you look for classical solutions, look at classical solutions from a four-dimensional discrete point of view?
That is exactly what this action should, which I want to achieve with this action, to generate solutions by looking at the equations of motion. So once one solves these equations of motion, the solutions are a four-dimensional simplicity complex, which is geometric, so such that each of the tetrahedron has unique area that everything has a geometric interpretation.
Would be enough to have at least one classical solution and then look at small perturbations and look at the dynamics of perturbations. Do you know if there's some simple solution, for instance, putting most of the variables to zero and look at something that is as close as possible to flat space?
So indeed, I have not found a classical solution that is a global solution. So far, I just looked at the solutions of the equations of motion along one edge, but that doesn't give you me a four-dimensional picture because I would have to glue these solutions in a non-trivial way. So that is what I'm working on, but I don't have solutions of these equations of motion. Probably as, unless for very special cases, it is probably as hard as finding solutions to Einstein.
Right, equation. But I can find the flat space solution of Einstein's equation without doing any work. Right?
Yes, yeah, this I have not. I have not found flat space in this format. Yes, I should look at that.
Okay, so let's continue on the same line of thought as Eugenio just mentioned. So when we get this is supposed to be a classical theory, which hopefully has something to do with general relativity. And now the question is what? So I come back to the question of time again and some related issues. The first is that I'm perfectly fine if you say that, well, in Regge calculus, one has this triangulation of the manifold, but it is not, the geometries are not twisted. The tetrahedra are regular, and here you've got twisted ones. Fine, and I'm happy. So you've got this triangulation. But still, now in the geometry, in what sense is it true that what you call T has anything to do with time? Namely, you started the whole seminar by saying that in the canonical approach, one is actually putting the Hamiltonian constraint, H operating on psi is equal to zero.
That is not some random thing that one is writing down. That has a very, classically, it has a very precise meaning. Namely, it does generate what we all know to be the multi-fingered time. So it's not unique, but we know what multi-fingered time is in general relativity, and that's what it generates. So your little t, it seems to me, has absolutely nothing to do with that multi-fingered time. And if I'm wrong, please tell me. Even if it has nothing to do with it, then the question is really about in what sense are we then going back and closing the circle and solving the first Hamiltonian constraint in this whole thing. And then there is a related question. Let me ask.
Wolfgang, can I venture an answer to Obai?
Go ahead.
Yeah, if there is a truncation of the model which does reproduce flat space, if one picks all the spinner or twister variables to be constant so that the volumes of the tetrahedra are all constant, then basically the theory reduces to equation 21, to the action equation 21, for a collection of free particles with momenta T, and T is now the proper time of those particles, with four lines X of T interacting with some vertices that correspond to four simplices. And the equations of motion for the X is, after the term 22 for the boundaries, which reminds us of relative locality, give us terms for embedding the vertices or the points representing the four simplices in the flat space-time given by the X is dual to the momentum space that the T's live in. And that gives a flat space interpretation of a truncation of the action. I think that that's a starting point to answer a bias query.
It was a little difficult to understand you, Lille, just because there was some, I don't know, some vibration or something. Maybe Wolfgang can repeat what you said for us.
Instead, I would prefer just to answer Abai's question. So, indeed, it is. I don't want to claim this, and I have not claimed this in this talk, that this Hamiltonian is the corresponds to a discretization of the ADM Hamiltonian. So far, what I've just observed is that I can write this discretized theory, which has a Hamiltonian formulation, and which one then can ask to quantize. So, but if I want to, if I ultimately want to connect this time variable with the ADM, with the ADM time, I should. What I should do is to look at a similar construction, just in terms of ADM variables, where one studies. So where I just repeat all of these steps in a foliation, and then I think it could be possible to relate this time to the ADM. But I agree with Abai that this is an open.
So Lee, it was a bit difficult to understand exactly what you said, but you are saying that there is somehow, in some sense, a solution to the equations that Wolfgang writes down, which can be interpreted as flat space, a flat space time. Is that correct?
Yes. Let me speak louder, and let me pose it as a question, because it's a conjecture. Let me put it this way. If one truncates the theory to equation 21 and 22 with fixed volumes, then one has a system of free particles in the space X's, which is dual to the momentum space, which is a flat space-time. It inherits the metric of flat space-time from the momentum space. And you have an action, therefore, for a system of particles representing the edges dual to tetrahedra, with a T representing proper time of those particles interacting in vertices which are dual to the four simplices. And in this truncation, there is an interpretation in terms of a system of particles moving in flat space-time where the trajectories of the flat particles are dual to tetrahedra and the vertices are dual to four simplices. Is that clear?
Not really, because in what sense is little t then the time of flat space, and which time is it in flat space?
It's the proper time along the world lines of the particles which are dual to the tetrahedra.
So there is only one simplex?
No, there's an arbitrary number of simplices. For each simplex, for each fourth simplex, there's a point where five particles come together, where five world lines come together, some incoming and some outgoing.
These world lines are random, or they are straight lines, they are what?
They're straight lines in the flat metric, which is dual to the metric in momentum space.
Okay, but then at each vertex, the edge splits into different edges, right? So now, this time one can follow it through different trajectories in some sense.
This is a truncation, but my conjecture, and I'm making it as a question, is whether there's a solution to the full equation with the twistorial variable simply constant, so that the volume squares are constant corresponding to massive particles which all have the same mass.
Okay, so I guess we have to think about it. But there's a related question, which is that if we had such an interpretation, even then, when Olgang and I did counting of degrees of freedom, we just don't say anything like 2 degrees of freedom. We don't say anything like transverse traceless modes. And so do you see anything like transverse traceless modes if you were to do perturbation theory? It seems that there are too many degrees of freedom, right? There were 3 local degrees of freedom per space point. And so it doesn't look like general relativity at all to me. And kind of this is the elementary question that anybody from outside the community is going to ask us, that if you have quantum theory, then, you know, how many degrees of freedom at low energy does it have? And it seems to me that there's an issue here. There's a fundamental problem here. But maybe I'm wrong, and somebody, you know, either Lee or Simone or Wolfgang can comment on this. Let me just repeat. I mean, the whole idea here is to say that, well, we have got this twisted geometries, and that gives us some degrees of freedom. I mean, and you can do the count. Wolfgang can do a counting for us. That the counting of this tetrahedra, which has, so to say, certain quantities are fixed but others are not, that counting does not give us 2 transverse traceless degrees of freedom.
Yeah, so the problem here is that the variables that belong to one tetrahedron are in a sense non-local because they are smeared variables. It's not that... So they capture not just the gravitational field at a point, but on an entire tetrahedron. So at each point of an edge corresponds to not just to a point literally, but to an entire three-dimensional region, to a tetrahedron. And therefore, I would say the counting is not so obvious that one should get just 2 degrees of freedom for each tetrahedron. What I find, however, intriguing is that along these edges I get a shear, which I hope that I can that there is a way to relate this to the degrees of freedom of a gravitational wave. And, but this is just a vague conjecture. It's possible to me. So the message is that the degrees of freedom over each point correspond to expanded quantities, to some non-local construction, and therefore it is not obvious that one should get 2 degrees at each point.
So just to add to this, I completely agree that the question of the number of degrees of freedom in the semi-classical continuum limit is crucial. If we are in Regge calculus, we have a standard procedure to do that, which is to use a regular lattice and identify the variables, and it's not necessarily trivial, but we know how to do it. And the whole question here is that for these twisted geometries, we don't really know how to do it. So this action that Wolfgang introduced, I think also together with another action that has been recently proposed by Laurent and Jeff, I think are worthwhile being studied from this point of view to see if, forget about quantization, just if they have a mean continuum limit per se, and what number of degrees of freedom can be identified in that procedure.
Right. So my question is really whether this continuum limit has anything to do with general relativity at all. So there are two different questions. One question is a question of mathematical physics, which is that this looks like a very interesting action. Let's explore what happens. Second is a question which says that this has something to do with quantum gravity, or this is quantum gravity. And I was really hoping for the second one, and the question that I was asking came from the second question, second point of view. If you just want to think of it as a mathematically interesting field theory, I completely agree. You can explore, one can explore it and say what it says. And it may not be general relativity. It may have more degrees of freedom or whatever, which is fine. But
I think the most important point is that this is a classical framework. All of these problems also appear in the quantum theory. But studying them in the in this classical framework is a much simpler problem. So instead of studying one spinform model after the other and trying for each of them to recover the correct semi-classical limit, this is a more general framework where one, where we can study spinforms on a classical level and see whether they whether it already makes sense there.
I wholeheartedly agree with Wolfgang, but I want to ask Simone then. So, Simone, so you think that this, in the class, I mean, if you look at it, take Wolfgang's point of view, and we actually have the study, the classical limit, and that's the whole point up here, that are you saying that this, it doesn't matter if this has nothing to do with general relativity? Because if there is a continuum limit, hopefully it is diffeomorphism invariant. So one would like to know what it is. Now, if I had something like just the scale of curvature, then I know what the, in the action, in the continuum, then I know what the degrees of freedom are. There are exactly 2 degrees of freedom. Even if I had the simplest R-squared potential terms, like in the Starobinsky model, right? Then the statement is that that is equivalent to having another degree of freedom. So, in fact, if you turn out that this model actually corresponds to 3 degrees of freedom, then we would say, okay, this corresponds to something like this, you know, scalar curvature plus R squared term. So that is the kind of question that I want to ask.
Exactly. More than R squared, you know, because we're starting with a theory that is somehow first-order formalism, one might expect things related with extra degrees of freedom maybe could be associated with torsion. That would be a natural expectation because to some extent that's where we were starting from. So, taking the continuum limit of this action, like putting it on a regular lattice, chopping it into 4 simplices and seeing what happens is, of course, I completely agree, a very important question. It's not obvious this identification with the diffeomorphism, right, because of the twisting of the geometries. In the usual case, you do know that it arises in the continuum limit of Regge calculus because you can do infinitesimal vertices displacements. But now that the edges are not necessarily uniquely identified, this is not obvious to me that you can do that in the same way. So,
right. So if you don't, if the continuum limit is not diffeomorphism invariant, I'm afraid that most people don't take it very seriously. Maybe you can say that that's not true, but that's...
No, for sure, I agree. The hope would be that it would still be diffeomorphism invariant plus maybe some torsional freedom, but to be seen.
Okay.
Just one question related
to... One more question?
I agree with the virus. This is an important question. Is that this is based on a discretization of the linear simplicity constraints rather than the usual quadratic simplicity constraints. And I have to ask the experts at this point, my understanding is that there is not a continuum action with linear simplicity constraints, but is anything known about the degree of freedom counting of the theory with the simplicity constraints imposed as linear constraints?
Well, there is actually, I have to disagree with this. There's actually an action by Oriti and and Stefan Gielen, who proposed such an action. And
okay,
this is an action for BF theory plus linear for this constraint.
And does that have 2 degrees of freedom as general relativity?
Well, they show that the action is equivalent to GR, so it has should have 2 degrees of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, but not
okay.
Maybe in the sense that you mean, because at the if you want to do the Hamiltonian analysis of this action, it has the peculiarity that the simplicity constraints that they use are not regular. You cannot use the standard Dirac algorithm. If you did this naively, you would get basically a wrong degree of freedom. You get a negative number of degrees of freedom. So we don't know for the moment how to do the Hamiltonian analysis of this action with linear constraints.
Both of you agree that at the Lagrangian level, at the action level,
the
claim is that it gives a general relativity. So in that sense, thanks very much.
More questions?
Are there any more questions?
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.